Hola, I'm Gustavo Arellano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times and host of the podcast The Times, daily news from the LA Times. I'm very excited to be your guest host for the next couple of weeks. Let's bring on the desmadre. Welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It's the second week of June, a busy one in politics, and not just because of the January 6th hearings on primary elections across the country. President Joe Biden is here in Los Angeles to host the Summit of the Americas, an event that's supposed to bring together leaders from across the Western Hemisphere. Biden's looking to make diplomatic progress on migration and the economic devastation and violence that drives it. You know, the easy stuff. Can he succeed? Let's bring on our left, right, and center panel. I'm your guest host and your left, even though I'm kind of a Rancho Libertarian. But we still have a center and a right and a special guest. On the right, I'm joined by Sarah Isger. She's the host of the legal podcast, Advisory Opinions from the Dispatch. She was a spokesperson at the Department of Justice under President Trump. Sarah, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
From the center, we're joined by Tara Settmayer. She's a senior advisor at the Lincoln Project and a resident scholar at the University of Virginia Center for Politics. And back when she was still a Republican, she was a communications director on Capitol Hill. Hello, Tara.
Thank you for having me back.
And we're also joined by our special guest, my compa, Julio Ricardo Varela. He's co-host of In the Thick Political Podcast and editorial director of Futuro Media. Thanks for being here, Julio.
It's a pleasure. Thanks for the invite.
Okay, so fair or not, what's overshadowed the agenda for this Summit of the Americas is who's not in attendance. The Biden administration chose not to invite Cuba, Nicaragua, and Venezuela, citing their record on democracy, and that led to diplomatic snubs in response by El Salvador, Guatemala, Honduras, and most notably, Mexican President Andrés Manuel López Obrador, who sent his foreign minister instead. Julio, can the U.S. accomplish anything worthwhile without Mexico there? And what's with this RSVP disaster?
The Summit of the Americas has such an interesting history because that people don't even know that it started in the 90s, right after NAFTA, right, with Bill Clinton. So I think there's a lot of attention on a summit that people think has this, like, deep history. And it's pretty clear that the Biden administration just totally missed the boat on this one and kind of underestimated the political moment and how people like López Obrador and even the Central American presidents have been able to kind of send a message to the Biden administration saying, you know what, United States, you're not the regional power anymore. We got China, so we're good. So we're not showing up. So here's my foreign minister. And Biden and the administration are trying really hard to save a little face. I mean, Jair Bolsonaro, the president of Brazil, and Biden meeting on Thursday, which was the first time that they both met. But I just think it's a summit that really is just a photo op now. I don't think anything's going to come out of this. Biden calls for consensus. Okay, great. Let's move on.
Immigration, of course, that's obviously a big topic of the summit, not just in the United States, but across Latin America. And when Biden took office, he reversed some Trump-era restrictions, but he also kept others, citing the pandemic. Sarah, what do you make of the new proposals that are being unveiled at the summit, especially this call to action for more countries to host people that are fleeing violence?
Immigration has plagued the Biden administration since they've come into office. It's been a leading issue among voters now for several years. I mean, there's a real argument that it overtook abortion, for instance, as the main culture war issue on the right, immediately preceding when Donald Trump won the Republican nomination back in 2016. So fast forward, and you have this crisis at the border. And I think you can define the crisis differently, but I'm not sure at this point that anyone is disputing the crisis aspect of it. There's a humanitarian crisis, there's a rule of law crisis, but regardless, we have thousands of people in an untenable situation at the southern border. And the Biden administration has yet to find their footing, policy-wise or messaging-wise. You know, initially, he tried to put Vice President Harris in charge of it. She kind of Heismaned that assignment. Understandably, it's a lose-lose assignment. And so, fast forward to this summit, what can get done at a summit where the parties are not on equal footing with one another and their interests are not particularly well aligned either? I compare it to something like the G7 or the Five Eyes, where you have countries coming together who have sort of mutual interests. Here, it feels a lot more like America lecturing other countries on what they need them to do to make their political situation more workable. And I don't think that's going to work for the Biden administration. And certainly domestic politics-wise, it's not going to help the Democrat situation heading into the fall.
Yeah, of course, though, the United States has been lecturing Latin America on what to do and what not to do since the Monroe Doctrine way back in the days.
For centuries.
Tara, your thoughts?
Well, I think it's fair to say that the timing of this summit couldn't have been at a worse time for the Biden administration. Mm. They're dealing with so many other things that this was, which doesn't surprise me that it hasn't gone as well as they thought it would, because they've been a little distracted. Okay. So, and unfortunately, it does feel as though that what's happening south of our border and in the Latin America region hasn't gotten the attention that it deserves. And it's been an ongoing problem across multiple administrations for decades. So the Biden administration is a little behind the curve, given everything else that's going on. And also the fact that during the Trump administration, relationships in Latin America weren't exactly great either. Because of the neglect in the region during the Trump administration, outside of just the rhetoric about being tough on immigration and some of the more negative comments that Trump has made outside of Brazil and Bolsonaro, because they are kindred spirits, it has allowed China to really maneuver its way into the region, which is extremely problematic. And this is where I think that the Biden administration understands that this is a strategic problem. China has been creeping up into the sphere of influence of America in this Western hemisphere for years now. But most notably in 2017, they saw an opening given Donald Trump's posture toward Latin America. They started their Belt and Road Initiative in 2017. What is that? That's similar to the ancient Silk Road establishment of trade routes and maritime routes. They've been doing this in other regions across the world, but they saw Latin America as a rich place to begin this starting in the early 2000s because of Latin America's raw materials and commodities there. So they've decided to really begin investing here. And you have 19 countries in Latin America who are part of this Belt and Road Initiative. And this is also what's allowing some of those other countries to ignore the United States, because they have China, who is an incredible trading partner. They are the number one trading partner for Latin America, except for Mexico. And this is really where money talks.
So if China's coming in, I want to focus on that in a little bit, but what are some other opportunities for success then at the summit? If it's already kind of a flop for the Biden administration, what can Biden and these other countries propose to counter China? Julio, really quickly.
I mean, seriously, I think there needs to be a realistic conversation about, you know, there's attempts at migration and the reality, but I also think the United States needs to wake up a little bit and understand that this is not the Latin America, even of the 90s or of the 80s, that Biden, to be honest with you, has been involved with. I think this is a really tough pill to swallow for the United States for two reasons. One, you know, they're not the only player anymore in the region. That's obvious. And, you know, Russia used to be, but now China is. And they don't have a clear policy for that. And they're quickly just following Trump policy in a lot of ways, because they feel like they have, you know, we can't upset voters in Miami. But number two, they're missing a major opportunity with the U.S. Latino community to understand that Latin America is actually very complex. It's actually more connected to the communities in California, in the Southwest, in the Northeast, you know, in Florida, in places like that. And understanding that they could actually be an ally for you. But I think the policy is just, you know, it's just policy from like a bad Latin American history class from the 90s. That's basically what we're seeing.
Sarah, what could the Biden administration or other countries propose in terms of opportunities on economics?
I think that at this point, there is no particular win coming out of this for the Biden administration that does not include something on immigration issues. And I don't think that necessarily has to be our southern border, but I think it has to be economic and political changes in these countries that could stem some of their political violence that's causing some of the migration. As you mentioned at the top, being a better sanctuary for people fleeing violence from other parts of the world who are coming through South and Latin America and making their way up to the United States. But the most important thing to me really is that at this point, we've created an economy that is benefiting drug cartels, because that's who you're really paying when you're paying, you know, $10,000 to a coyote to move someone across the border and to make multiple attempts. I mean, this is rational economics happening. And the problem is you're massively enriching these non-governmental organizations that are dangerous, violent, involved in sex trafficking, human trafficking, and obviously drug trafficking. And unless and until you create a system that doesn't enrich those organizations, again, I just don't know what other economic policy could possibly matter at this point.
That's not even going to be a Latin America thing. That's going to be the United Americans just stop using drugs. And that's never going to happen, sadly.
Well, not when it, but that problem has been going on for a long time. This is talking about human smuggling, where the drug cartels are making an enormous amount now moving people from El Salvador up to Laredo, for instance. So we're way past the drug wars of the 90s and early aughts. This is now a human smuggling operation.
Yeah, the answer to that, of course, is having open borders. I mean, my dad came across the country across the border in the trunk of a Chevy, through a sewer, hopped a fence. Way back in the days, it was far easier because there was a border patrol, but it wasn't that like operation lockdown that, by the way, didn't start with the Trump administration, started with the Clinton administration, setting this border, making people go across the desert and dying through that.
Two things. One, obviously, I wholeheartedly disagree with an open border policy. I think, you know, that is not practical. And for security reasons, that's something else that we should not be entertaining. And that was why the Merida Initiative was discussed during the Bush administration and carried over as a regional strategic security cooperation agreement between the U.S. and Mexico and the Northern Triangle countries. But it's so no, open borders is not the answer. I will respectfully disagree on that. However, one of the initiatives that the Biden administration is proposing during the conference is this America's Partnership for Economic Prosperity. That's supposed to be this economic package that the Biden administration is putting forward to try to combat some of the, well, like I said before, some of China's influence there and the investment that they've made. It's calling for more investment. It's calling for more supply chain issues to help relieve the supply chain. It doesn't go far as getting rid of some of the tariffs, or, you know, it focuses more on the like-minded partnerships that the U.S. already has primarily. But at least it's something substantive that the Biden administration is offering, as well as some climate change initiatives as well with some of the countries. So they're trying to put forward some policy, substantive policy initiatives that they can get agreement on coming out of this. And we'll see.
But here's the biggest problem. And you could say whatever administration since the 90s, you know, everyone's, you know, I have to say, you know, from Clinton to Bush to Obama to Trump, to Biden, what's happened since the mid-90s is that, and it's to Gustavo's point, is that migration has become, in essence, an enforcement issue, right? And in a post-9/11 world, when you created an agency such as ICE, but a lot of people think ICE is a long agency. It's only been around since right after 2001. The Department of Homeland Security has only been around since, you know, post-2001. And I think what's happened in this country is that it's turned around the issue in a way that what we're seeing is a complete dehumanization of migration. And what we're also seeing is this lack of any understanding of the forces. So Biden is inheriting, you know, and maintaining policies like Title 42, which have roots in World War II when we weren't allowing, you know, Jewish survivors of the Holocaust in this country. So I think we have to be very careful in terms of framing the migration debate in a sense that it's not really left or right anymore. It's American bipartisan policy. And it's because there's this fear that what is coming from whatever the global South is not us. And unless that debate changes, we're going to have the same migration question, the same immigration question for the next 30, 40 years.
But I think some of that is not understanding what the other side actually thinks about immigration and why they disagree with open borders, because it's not just fear of the other. I think that's
correct.
A trope about racism.
This has nothing to do with open borders. This is about how we look at migration. It's a different debate.
Fine, but you said people who oppose immigration are fearing the other, implying that there's a racial tinge to it.
There is a racial tinge to it.
There always has
there
been.
Is a racial tinge to
okay,
it.
Okay, then what I'm telling you is that you don't understand why some people can oppose immigration for reasons that aren't related to that.
But it is. I don't believe it anymore. It's been 30 years. I do not
okay,
believe
well then
it
you're
anymore.
Not trying to understand the other side of the debate.
Let me jump in really quickly and just put it back to the summit part. A lot of this migration is because of the economics of the region. So to Tara's point, Sarah, do you think by investing more in these countries, does that keep people there? And also, does that check China from getting even more influence in Latin America?
I would love for the answer to that to be yes. We just don't see a lot of data to support that outcome. The Obama administration invested a ton of money into the Northern Triangle countries as our immigration system and flow is really changing. You know, it used to be mostly single men coming from Mexico. During the early aughts, the beginning of the Obama administration, that really shifted to be families coming from, again, a lot of Northern Triangle countries. And so they put tons of money into trying to pump up the economy, stabilize the governments of those Northern Triangle countries. It did not stem the flow. And instead, what you see this year and last year is ever increasing record numbers of people coming to the border. And again, not what we were seeing in the 90s or aughts of single men, but family units, unaccompanied minors.
I don't know about single men, because I know a lot of friends of mine who brought their families over during the 90s and have been undocumented under DACA for the past 20 years at this point.
Sarah's not wrong about that statistically. I worked on immigration issues when I worked on Capitol Hill for 7 years from 2006 to 2013. And there is definitely a shift in the numbers and who's coming and why. And a lot of that has to do with domestic policies in the United States as far as economics. And on both sides, there has been an unwillingness to do comprehensive immigration reform, to reform our guest worker programs, to make certain policy changes within the U.S. that combine the enforcement part, the economic part of it. There's been an unwillingness on both sides to try to approach these problems. So there can be a humane immigration reform in this country, but we're not going to solve that tomorrow.
And we're not going to solve it at the Summit of the Americas. I'll be back with Tara Setmayer, Sarah Isger, and Julio Ricardo Varela to talk about what to make of primary election results. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from across the political spectrum. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Gustavo Ariano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times, your guest host coming at you from the left for a couple of weeks. In the center is Tara Setmayer. She's a senior advisor at the Lincoln Project. On the right is Sarah Isger, staff writer and podcast host at The Dispatch. And our special guest, Julio Ricardo Varela, co-host In the Thick political podcast and editorial director of Futuro Media. There was another round of primaries across the country this week with some big races in states like California. Pundits like to draw national conclusions from local races, and sometimes that's a mistake, but we can't help ourselves, so we're going to do it right now. In San Francisco, voters recalled District Attorney Chesa Boudin, one of the nation's high-profile progressive prosecutors. In Los Angeles, Republican turned independent, turned Democrat, billionaire Rick Caruso easily made it into a runoff with Congresswoman Karen Bass for mayor. Caruso talked tough on homelessness and expanding the police force and has already spent $40 million of his own money to get to this point. Sarah, I know you're not in Cali, but I'm wondering if you see voters who are unhappy about crime and homelessness switching their priorities to law and order candidates, because like Boudin was part of a wave of progressive prosecutors who were elected in the wake of the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson. Are voters turning away from that? And if so, what does that mean for Democrats in the midterms?
It's pretty clear the answer to that is yes. The San Francisco Chronicle did a really interesting precinct by precinct data analysis. And while Not surprisingly, the precincts that were most likely to vote for Boudin when he got into office still supported him at a higher level, and vice versa. Those who opposed him voted for his recall at a higher level. There were many precincts, like in the Tenderloin district of San Francisco, that had voted him into office and now voted him out of office. What I think is interesting about San Francisco, and maybe has been missed in this, is that the national trends aren't that different from the local trends in San Francisco. And folks have pointed to that to say how unfair it is then that Boudin is recalled from office when he is simply sort of the victim of a national rise in crime, if you will. But I think that's missing the point if you're a Democratic operative heading into a 2022 midterm election. Exactly. The most progressive voters in the country are so unhappy with the rise in crime that, again, is happening nationally, that they are voting more conservatively than they did just a few years ago. So absolutely, I think this is a trend that will continue through the fall. I think it is particularly bad for some Democrats, not all. And that while I think there are ways to overread what we saw in California, particularly in the LA mayor's race, which has some weird idiosyncrasies, I think that the law and order issue with Chesa Boudin in that recall for DA is front and center when you're thinking about issues second to inflation in the economy.
Julio, what do you think?
You know, I wanted to focus on, you know, following what happened this week, but also what happened in South Texas. I don't know if you've been following those primary runoffs, but there were two specific districts. One of them, Michelle Vallejo, who was a progressive, Latino progressive, who actually won the Democratic nominee, and is actually, that's one of the districts where Republicans are really like priming to take over so that they can win a House majority. In the neighboring district, you had incumbent, you know, Henry Cuellar, who's perhaps one of the most moderate Democrats, very pro Border Patrol.
He's a pro-life
as well.
Pro-life, pro-gun, against Jessica Cisneros, who's very, you know, progressive, used to work in for Cuellar. And it was the third time, I believe, that she tried to defeat him. And he was also investigated by the FBI. But it does speak to the fact of certain districts in this country are tied, right, to, it's about knowing your constituents, right? So Cuellar won, right? He won. It wasn't a big number, but you win, right? And he's an incumbent, and he's probably the best chance Democrats have in South Texas to stave off any of the Republican advances that have happened, especially given that Joe Biden in Cuellar's county did the best throughout South Texas. But it does speak to the bigger issue of, has the pendulum shifted? Have we seen a small window of progressive causes sort of beginning to dissipate? The Biden-Harris campaign might have attracted people in 2020, but the proof is in the pudding, right? And I think that's where you're going to see lack of enthusiasm. There's, you know, people saying, I don't really want to vote. And I think there were reports, Gustavo, I think I read that the turnout in California wasn't that dynamic at all. It was abysmal, right? So basically what you're seeing is more of a disengaged electorate. The people that are going to vote are going to be the people that want to vote for something, whether it's being safe, for what's happening in the headlines, whatever. That's what I think is going to happen. And I expect a shellacking by midterms. I think the Republicans might win both the House and the Senate this time around.
Tara, in 2018, Democrats picked up House seats in California. You and I know about Orange County, and the GOP took some of those back in 2020. And of course, with Trump, made gains, like in South Texas and other Latino communities. And for the primary, you did have one Republican out in California, Lan He Chen. He placed in first for the state controller race. And if he wins, he'd be the first Republican elected in California to statewide office. 2006, when Arnold Schwarzenegger was reelected as governor and another GOPer became insurance commissioner. What does a better performing GOP in California mean for other parts of the country?
Well, I think that in Chen's case, he's a bit of a moderate. At least he's not a Trumper. He, you know, worked for Mitt Romney, and he's an academic, and so came from the Bush Bush world. So he's not exactly what you would think of today's Trump or Republican Party, which makes him more palatable to folks out there in California, in some of the regions of California that are a little bit more conservative. People think California is this big progressive bastion, which it is mostly, except there are regions where it isn't. And Orange County,
like San Francisco with Boudin
right,
now. Damn.
Right. I don't think so. But Orange County used to be, you know, they used to consider that the most Republican, you know, area in the country. And we've seen the way things have changed there. I just think that it depends on how the candidate and where it is. I don't know that we can read something nationally out of what happened in California other than the kitchen table issues of crime and inflation were driving forces behind particularly the San Francisco and LA races, and that people will always vote their local interests usually, right? All politics is local. And what's going on in San Francisco and what's happening in LA, it didn't matter what your partisan label was at that point. It was, how are you going to fix this? And Caruso was very smart. He's been a Republican the majority of his life. He just became a Democrat basically to run for mayor. And LA hasn't seen a Republican mayor since the 90s. Another time where crime was running rampant and they needed to have some serious changes. It's a city now that's looking for change because the status quo is untenable. So Caruso went out there and sold that change. You know, he had an expression, 30,000 shelter beds in 300 days. You know, people remembered that. He used his own money to put up, you know, ubiquitous campaign messaging around either on the airwaves or billboards. You know, people were familiar with his real estate, you know, malls and things there in LA. So, and then you had celebrities also out there in California supporting him. And you say what you will about the influence of Hollywood outside of
Snoop
LA
Dogg,
County.
Katy Perry.
Yeah, Kim Kardashian.
Gwyneth,
yes,
for crying
Gwyneth
out loud.
Gwyneth Paltrow, right. So, you know, it's similar to what happened in New York City also in the 90s with Rudy Giuliani. So these are typically progressive areas that were willing to go with law and order Republicans because of what was specifically happening in their cities. And those candidates offered better solutions. So we'll see. He still has a tough race against Karen Bass in the fall. There's still a runoff.
On the other hand, though, you had a candidate who was law and order, literally. It's just Sheriff Alex Villanueva, who was campaigning against woke culture, totally supporting the attempted recall of another progressive district attorney in LA County, George Gascon. He would do these big issues, going out to fight homelessness, fight crime. And when it came to the primary, he got the lowest ever vote. He did come out in first place with 34% of the vote, the lowest ever for an incumbent in LA County history. So you do have voters who are tired of crime, tired of that. But I wonder if it's a little bit overplayed as well, because like you have this progressive DA movement across the country. In St. Louis, their version of DA, she got reelected in 2020. Yeah. In Philadelphia, you have Larry Craster, who has been hated forever, and he won a couple of years ago. So I think with Chessa, a lot of it was, I think, also how you present yourself. Down here in Southern California, we think of Chessa as being very smug, and no one likes a smug official. And also, how much of a woke backlash was it when you have London Breed, the mayor, who maybe is not that far on the woke front, but she's pretty liberal, if not leftist, supporting that recall as well?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, again, there are parts of this that are very local. You had the mayor of the city saying, I can't work with this district attorney to reduce crime.
Yeah.
That's a deal breaker, I would think, for most voters. And so you have that momentum about recall elections, that anger and that conduit to voters, how to get information to them and get them activated, that I don't think you saw in some of those other cities that you mentioned where change didn't win that day.
Speaking of anger, Sarah, in the House races from Iowa to Montana, we saw Trump endorsing candidates. What do you hear from how Trump-backed candidates did?
It's really mixed. I mean, you have to look at this now in the big picture of all the primaries we have. And again, it can be very idiosyncratic when you look at Ohio Senate, where the Trump candidate won, Pennsylvania, where it was a tie and the Trump candidate ended up winning after the recount,
Dr.
and Georgia,
Oz.
Where the Trump candidate lost in the gubernatorial primary. You know, Trump's overall record is very good, but for most of those, he was endorsing a clear front runner. And so you have to look at those really, you know, contested contested primaries to determine what his endorsement is worth. Interestingly, there's been a lot of data analysis on this, and the answer appears to be that if sort of that you have a tailwind where Trump endorses and the local Republican officials all kind of get behind the same person, then the Trump endorsement matters. But if Trump is at odds with other Republican officials local in the area, or that person has really high name ID, voters already know them, then the Trump endorsement's worth a lot less.
Julio, yeah. You said earlier that the Democrats are, it's going to be a very bad midterms for them. So what should the Biden administration and Dem leaders be doing differently, especially to motivate young folks to come out and also the coalition of voters who came out to defeat Trump just 2 years ago?
I think they have to be incredibly bold in the next couple of months. And they do have opportunities, right? I mean, you know, you have the possibility of you know, Roe v. Wade ending. You know, this whole inflation thing is real, right? There was a recent poll when you look at Latinos, you know, when you look at communities that are not as, you know, affluent, who are living paycheck to paycheck. These are real issues, right? And I think there are pockets, right? I mean, I think this notion of localness and the overwokeness, I mean, I'm in a city right now in Boston that elected its first, you know, Asian American mayor in Boston. Right. And it's probably probably the future of the progressive movement in the United States. But I do think there's something missing with Democratic messaging. I totally understand Republican messaging on all its fronts. It's very effective. They stick to points. They stick to the script and they just keep hammering and hammering and hammering away. However you believe in it or not. But I still don't know what the message is coming from the Democratic Party. And I do think that there are indications that at least Republicans can win the House. Could they take over the Senate? It's quite possible at this stage. So I don't know when Democrats will wake up. I really don't.
Really quickly, Tara, is to be bold to be center?
Well, I think,
I'm
mean,
sorry,
if you
I had
look
to go
at
there.
The, yeah, no, I think that's fair. I mean, they're the fastest growing constituency of voters is the unaffiliated independent lane. So that doesn't always mean that you're moderate. They could be left of center, right of center, but it is primarily in the center somewhere. And for the House districts, it's all in how the districts are drawn, right? Versus the Senate races or statewide races, you have a more mixture in the constituency. So it varies. And I think that the way the candidates run and the messages that they bring to it will make that determination. I mean, if you look at what's happening in places like Pennsylvania or Georgia or Arizona, Wisconsin, even California and Texas, you see progressive pockets, but then you also see the extremist right pockets that you wouldn't imagine. I don't think a lot of people would have thought that Pennsylvania would be so Trumpy, with an Oz, Dr. Oz as a candidate and Mastriano as a gubernatorial candidate, who I personally think will get trounced in the gubernatorial race there. But they're winning these primaries. So I think that if Democrats want to hold on to power, they cannot ignore the importance of the moderate vote and being pragmatic. And they have to sing from the same sheet of music the way that Republicans do. They've always been better at storytelling, Republicans have been, and storytelling from the same page. And so, you know, as long as there is all of these, the overall broader themes of who do you want in power and how will they improve your life or not improve your life, I don't know that Democrats have yet found that overarching message where people will associate with Democrats versus Republicans. And that's on them.
There was a message. His name was Bernie Sanders, but we know how that went. I've been talking with Julio Ricardo Varela. Thanks for joining us, man.
Thank you. It was a pleasure.
Sarah Isger and Tara Settmayer, we'll be back with the January 6th hearings. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Thanks for listening to Left, Right, and Center. Is there someone in your life who could benefit from hearing a civilized discussion from all sides? Share the show with them. You can stream all episodes at kcrw.com/LRC, straight from the KCRW app or wherever you listen to podcasts.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your guest host and left, Gustavo Arellano, columnist at the Los Angeles Times. On the right is Sarah Isger, staff writer at the Dispatch. From the center, we're joined by Tara Settmayer. She's a senior advisor at the Lincoln Project. The January 6th hearings began this week, and there was a steady drip, drip, drip of new info about that attack on the Capitol and the 2020 election in the lead-up. We'll talk much, much more about this next week, of course. But let's talk now about the timing of the hearings and the TV drama that the Dems are going for. Tara, these hearings, come on, let's admit it, it's a slickly produced media spectacle, but that's not always a bad thing. You were just talking about the Republicans and storytelling, so is this going to work for the Dems?
Well, I take issue with it just being a slickly produced spectacle. We're dealing with an incident that it has never happened in United States history. It was a direct attack on our democracy. It was a violent insurrection incited by the sitting president of the United States at the time. That has never happened in American history. So the fact that we are, that Democrats or the committee has allowed that narrative to get out there, I think is problematic. Now, on the flip side of that, they need, you know, the American people have very short attention spans. And in this age of TikTok and Instagram and social media, where you need shiny objects to keep people interested, I don't think it was a bad idea to bring in professional help to package it in a way that made it ready for prime time. So I just don't know that the American people fully understand the gravity of what took place. And it's up to the January 6th committee to make sure that they communicate that, because the truth is compelling. The visuals are heartbreaking, infuriating, and real. And it's up to them to tell that story. And I'm quietly confident that it will be compelling. Where I worry is that not enough American people are paying attention to this. You have Republicans that are trying to counter-program this with propaganda, with attacking the credibility of witnesses and doing what they do because they know that they cannot counter the narrative directly, given the damning evidence that the January 6th committee has found in their investigation.
You mentioned TikTok, and I'm not joking when I say this. I wonder if it would make more sense for especially the Democrats or the Biden administration to focus so much of the attention of how it's going to be played out on TikTok. We just saw in the Philippines, the son of Ferdinand Marcos was elected based mostly on a TikTok campaign that just spread across the young folks in the country, because young people, they're not going to be tuning in to C-SPAN. They're not going to be listening to NPR, even though they should, of course. They're going to get all of that information on TikTok. So if they focus on that, these little snippets, maybe you think they'd be more effective that way?
Well, unfortunately, that demographic doesn't vote in the same numbers as—
But they did in the Philippines. Maybe they'd care.
Well, that's the Philippines. It's a little bit different. And we've seen the influence of social media since 2011 influencing Democratic elections across the world. So there definitely is something to that. However, I think that the commission, I'm hoping they have an all-encompassing communication strategy, whether it's having snippets on TikTok for those folks, because unfortunately, I think the younger generations do not appreciate democracy, the state of our republic, why our constitution. There's less confidence in those institutions than there has been in the past. And that's not a good thing moving forward. So not to write off that demographic, I just think that they need to have a holistic approach to how they're communicating what took place. And if that means having snippets and, you know, produced a little 2-minute videos that explain what happened and show the highlights of it, well, that's fine. That's part of the new digital age that we live in, but not the entire focus. They need to just present the facts.
Sarah, who's the intended audience for these hearings, and who's actually going to end up tuning in?
That is such a good question, because for anyone who's remembers watching, you know, regular television before we all unplugged, there's a reason that shows, you know, the season for shows was the fall to the beginning of the summer. It was the school year, and it's because people travel during the summer. Once their kids are out of school, they're not keeping their regular schedule. They're moving, they're gone, they're visiting, they're, you know, staying outside later. So it's interesting, because they have complete control over when to have these hearings, that they've chosen to do it at a time that, for instance, no network executive would ever put your ratings boom for a TV show. You know, Seinfeld isn't going to air in late June. That was like the most 90s dated reference ever. Sorry.
On the other hand, though, the Watergate scandal hearings were actually in June. They started in June, mid-June.
That's true, although it's worth noting that at that point, there were only four stations on your television. Right. There was nowhere else to go. So I think it's a good question.
And no internet either.
Yeah.
But you had life to go check out, you know? People go play basketball or something.
I don't think Democrats are actually expecting this to be a viewership issue. If you're tuning into these hearings, you've already made up your mind on what you think about them. What they're trying to do is create snippets for television ads in the fall, for viral moments on social media, and that's why you're seeing it in, you know, these little chunks for the day. You know, in a confirmation hearing, for instance, for a Supreme Court justice, those hearings last all day. They can last 12 hours. That's not what they're doing for the January 6th hearing. They're doing 2-hour, 3-hour chunks each day, again, to allow room for that news cycle to capture one moment per day and hope that that trickles down into voters. I don't think it will be particularly successful for any number of reasons. I think people have, by and large, made up their mind on this, and in an era of inflation, crime, gas prices, baby formula shortage, they want sort of a forward-looking political moment. And the Democrats, unfortunately, are delivering this backward moment, despite the fact that I entirely agree with Tara about how important it is. Unfortunately, that's just not where I think most voters are.
And what a place that we live in where you had, I mean, we've seen so much of the footage, and these hearings promise to have never before seen footage, more charges and all of that. And we as a country, instead of really decrying that day and wanting to see something happen, we're like, well, you know, my gas is too expensive, which I totally get. But Tara, I still don't think we as a country have really wrestled with the significance of what happened. And these hearings, sadly, I think, I don't know if they're going to influence anyone unless there's like, you know, there's going to be some new stuff that are just going to be mind-blowing that you're just not going to be able to ignore. But then the Republicans are just going to spit it and say, yeah, ignore it.
So I don't know that that's the purpose. I don't think the purpose at this point is necessarily to change hearts and minds and translate that into changing voting behavior at the ballot box. As much as I would love for that to be the case, that there would be this grand awakening from a large constituency of people who have been in denial about what happened that day and that who've been in denial about the role that Trump played and the role that Republican elected officials played in all of this and leading up to the big lie. I would love for this great epiphany to happen and people go, oh yeah, maybe that's not okay. Maybe we need to vote out the people who supported an insurrection, who seem not to believe in our democracy anymore. But I don't know if that's the case, maybe. What I think the point of all of this is similar to what the Warren Commission did, what the 9/11 Commission did. And this needs to be for history. They need to present this case because it's not the committee's job to prosecute. That's the Department of Justice's job. But it is their job to demonstrate to the American people the conclusions they found in this investigation and for it to be written for the history books so that this is never repeated. Because when you have a practice run coup that with no consequences and folks aren't held accountable for it, that's all it is. It's a practice run. So I worry that the people who were involved in this, if they are not held accountable, if they don't pay a price, they'll be emboldened to come back and try it again, learning lessons from the mistakes they made the first time. And that would be the end of our democracy in America. And I don't want to see that.
Sarah, what are some of the most damning charges that you've seen so far today?
The ones that are going to make the largest impact are the ones that relate to what elected officials knew and what they didn't do to prevent it. You know, one of the things that we've really been waiting for, what happened to those takes on the video that Donald Trump eventually puts out in the afternoon? What do we know about what those previous takes were? What did he say? What did he know? And so I think that is something that I think everyone will be tuning in to see whether they have new information related to what Donald Trump knew and when he knew it. A lot of the other parts of this, and they've divided it into this color-coded system for themselves on the committee of who's assigned sort of what aspect of this investigation, but a lot of it overlaps with what the Department of Justice has been doing in their criminal trials for people at January 6th. I think on the other end of the spectrum, that will be the least informative part of these hearings because we have public trials going on where a lot of that information is coming out. So where the committee, I think, can do the most good are painting a portrait of that timeline, what's going on at the White House and in the Oval Office, the TikTok for that afternoon.
Huh. What are the both of you going to be watching for in week two of the hearings?
I'm going to be watching for how the Democrats on the committee continue to message this. I mean, we know that we have two Republicans, right? You have Cheney and Kinzinger, who have been considered heretics for just doing their duty and trying to get to the bottom of this, which is just ironic to me. But I'm curious to see how the testimony and depositions, who they choose to show during these hearings, how that's handled. Because there were so many. I mean, they interviewed hundreds and hundreds of people, and they have thousands of documents. How they synthesize that as part of, as Sarah said, the timeline portrait of certain things, not only that day, but also what led up to it. Because there was more than just what happened and what we saw happen on January 6th. There is a whole trail of folks that were involved in this, not only from the White House on down, but also, as we've seen, the seditious conspiracy charges against the Oath Keepers and the Proud Boys and others who were also involved in executing this. How they bring that all together. That's what I'll be watching for.
It's funny. I think that I'm just the opposite side of the coin. I'm very curious what Republicans will be saying during this. We've already seen that they've had a counter-programming plan. You know, there was a press conference shortly before the hearing started with leadership in the House, Republican leadership, and they were asked, you know, who's going to watch the hearing? And only one member raised their hand. So what are Republicans going to do? Just ignore it? Are they going to continue that counter-programming? And will they actually be more successful than Democrats in the end in terms of who's rallying their base better? I'm interested.
Tara, do you think the Republicans are going to come out looking good in all of this?
No, I think Republicans are scared to death of the truth, as I've mentioned. And one of the aspects of this that I find most troubling is the hypocrisy of Republicans, not only on the diminishing the attack on our institution of voting and elections, but also the way they've treated law enforcement. Now, we still see that Fox News and other places are going after the credibility of these law enforcement officers, which is in such contrast to what Republicans claim when they say they back the blue. No, they don't. They attack the blue. And I think that's absolutely despicable. And I think the American people should take a look at that and ask themselves, why in God's name would a party that's claiming the moral high ground, that nothing went wrong here, that would go after the brave men and women who defended them that day at the Capitol?
We're just going to have to leave it there because I have a feeling we're going to be chewing on this way more next week. And we've reached that time once again for our famed Left, Right, and Center rants, featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Sarah Isger, what's on your mind?
Well, this week, there was an attempted assassination of a Supreme Court justice. And obviously, I think we're missing a lot of nuance in these conversations when we say that so-and-so is to blame for a crazy person showing up with a gun. At the same time, at this point, it is foreseeable that if you focus your political allies onto one person as being the problem with an institution, there will be some crazy person out there with mental health issues or who knows what else who will take that message in a different direction. And we've seen it over and over again, whether it's, you know, Gabby Giffords or the congressional baseball shooting or now the attempted assassination of Brett Kavanaugh. He was showing up at his house because of an opinion that Samuel Alito wrote and because he was upset about the Uvalde shootings. And he believed that killing Brett Kavanaugh was the answer to that. Doxing people, this politics of outrage, it is creating an atmosphere where these things become more common, and it's dangerous, and it's corrosive.
Tara Settmayer, what's your rant?
My rant this week is about these PGA golfers deciding to sell out and play in this Saudi Arabian golf league that's out there because of money. And I just think that it's despicable that that Americans would take Saudi money, which is blood money, based on the way the Saudis have conducted themselves. We already know they have wide-ranging human rights abuses, the politically motivated killings, torture, forced disappearances, the inhumane treatment of prisoners, what happened to Jamal Khashoggi, their role in 9/11. I mean, the kingdom has a litany of grievances, particularly under their new leadership now with bin Salman. And that these PGA players would go because they're offering $250 million in prize money. Sometimes things are just not all about the money. And I'm glad to see that the PGA decided to suspend these these golfers. And I think that was the right thing to do. Phil Mickelson and Dustin Johnson need to think about the money that they're spending and the blood behind it after they win this money on the tour. Shame on them.
My rant's also going to be about sports. I think it's a record, two rants about sports for left, right, and center 1 week, which I think is cool. But anyways, here in my hometown of Anaheim, the Angels Major League Baseball team has two of the sport's most exciting players, outfielder Mike Trout and last year's American League MVP, pitching hitting sensation Shohei Ohtani. Sadly, Trout and Ohtani play for a dud. Yes, the team is under the 500 mark, but I'm talking about Angels owner Artie Moreno. He's an eternal gray cloud of bad luck. Moreno saddled the team for the last decade with past their prime stars who, surprise, flopped. The city of Anaheim is embroiled in a federal corruption scandal over trying to sell Angel Stadium to a Moreno-led company. And while the Angels aren't accused of any wrongdoing, their influence in local politics has caused community activists to ask the team to stay away this election cycle. Arte, sell the team already. Trout and Ohtani deserve so much better. And so do the fans who have to live with the eternal embarrassment that their Anaheim team goes by the name the Los Angeles Angels. Meanwhile, the Dodgers, LA's real team, they're laughing at your bubbling ways, Arte, from up the 5 freeway in first place. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks to Sarah Isger, Tara Settmeyer, and Julio Ricardo Varela. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Singer Schiff. The show is recorded and mixed by Matt Schwartz. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Gustavo Arellano. Thanks for joining us. Tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center. Gracias.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.